So for this morning, I thought I would talk for a little while and encourage you to kind of engage, maybe a little more than you usually do with what I'm saying, because I would like you to kind of set up a certain topic for your consideration, for your own exploration of this thing, and see what comes out of your own thoughts and life experience in relationship to this. And then if there's time, maybe I'd pick it up again and continue with some of my own thoughts. And to begin with, what I want to do is talk about a very central Buddhist myth. And myths are very interesting, the idea of a myth. Sometimes people can talk about other people's, oh, that's their myth. They live, but that's a myth they have, and they believe in all kinds of things. And they say, oh, it's just a myth. And so sometimes the word myth kind of is a little bit disparaging, a little bit disrespectful. So it's not really true, and it's just a story they tell themselves and whatever. And certainly some people believe their myths. And it's said that here everyone has myths they live by, and sometimes we don't realize the degree to which we have myths, both consciously and unconsciously, and kind of believe them. But another aspect of myth is that, maybe coming out of anthropology and coming out of psychology, is the idea that if you have the right eye, the right discernment, you can look at a myth and see that there's all kinds of truths there. Some people say universal truths or basic truths, or there's something encoded in the myth about the human process, the human psyche, the spiritual growth. And so you don't take the myth as being literally true, but you see it as being figuratively true or allegorically true, and it points to some aspect, kind of like a dream. You interpret it like a dream. Different aspects of the myth might all point to different aspects of oneself. And so the myth then has some deeper meaning as we kind of apply it to our own life, and has a different kind of level of kind of truth. It's maybe not literally true, but it's true because it speaks to the process of the psyche. So one of the core myths that much of Buddhism is organized around is the myth of the Buddha's enlightenment. And there's a number of elements to this myth. One is that prior to his final period of leading up to enlightenment, he spent many years being an ascetic. And here an ascetic is someone who's self-denying, to the extreme. It said that he lived an ascetic to the point of being on the verge of death. And apparently Buddha was very confident in himself and in his great abilities, and he knew that if he'd taken it one iota further, he would have died. And so the point was, what's the purpose of living an ascetic life if it just leads to death, if you do it thoroughly? So he pulled back from that kind of practice of self-denial, self-mortification, and wondered what to do next, and remembered an experience he had as a child of sitting quietly under a tree and not denying himself, not trying to do anything too actively, making anything happen, and somehow the heart, the mind, kind of settling by itself into a state of joy. And he thought, well, maybe I could do the same thing. Maybe I don't have to be afraid of joy. An ascetic kind of feeling joy and happiness was kind of considered taboo. So he decided to do that, and then he broke his long ascetic fast. And this woman came and offered him, mistook him for the spirit of a tree. She had apparently promised that if her childbearing bore fruit, was easy enough, that she would go offer this elaborate or fancy rice porridge meal to the spirit of this tree that she'd asked for protection and support from. And so the birth went well, and she came and she went to the tree that she, I guess, prayed under or whatever. And sitting under the tree was this ascetic, this renunciant, and that was the Buddha. And she mistook him for the spirit of the tree that somehow had manifested to receive the offering. So she then offered this porridge, this rich, creamy rice milk porridge, and which in ascetics is not supposed to eat. But the Buddha ate this in order to nourish himself, take care of himself. And then the story goes on to say that the Buddha then sat down one evening under the Bodhi tree with a commitment to sit still, to sit fast, no matter what arose, until he became awakened. And then as he sat there, he was assailed by the forces of Mara. And the forces of Mara is kind of like the Buddhist devil. And you can imagine someone who's been self-denying themselves for 6 years, their sexuality, their pleasure, their food, their, you know, all kinds of things, that you can imagine that once that lid's been taken off, that kind of repressive, perhaps, lifestyle, that suddenly all the inner psychic forces come in spades. And so the Buddha sat there, and Mara, all these inner psychic forces of temptation and fear and desire, and so you just came pouring into the Buddha, pouring out of the Buddha. And the instructive thing is here is that in some way the Buddha was able to sit still in that. He's held fast. And then at some point, the Mara came with the greatest challenge. The devil came with the greatest challenge, which is in the form of self-doubt. And at the kind of point where the Buddha, the Mara was going to kind of lose the battle, and Mara kind of came with self-doubt and said, "What right do you have to become free, to become liberated? You know, you're just, you know." And so the Buddha then didn't rely on his own powers, but rather reached down and touched the earth and with his right hand. And you've probably seen sometimes the sculpture of this very common depiction of Buddhist sculpture. So Buddha be touching the ground with his right hand. And what he's doing there, he calls upon the earth goddess, the goddess of the earth, to bear witness to his right to become free. And the earth goddess does that and chases Mara away. And then he sits there under the Bodhi tree. And then what happens is that the process of enlightenment is described as a process of opening his Dharma eye. And opening a Dharma eye is a very interesting expression because the implication is that he sees something he didn't see before. There's a new seeing, new vision that happens. Something that was unseen or unnoticed or undiscovered becomes noticed and discovered with the opening of the Dharma eye. And so, you know, what is this? What is this opening? You know, what is it? What is the unseen world that's available when the Dharma eye opens? What is the unseen world that we don't see yet, perhaps, or haven't, you know? And what is it to open the Dharma eye and see something new for this first time, or see some aspect of the hidden world, the unseen world? Is there an unseen aspect to your world? Is there an unseen aspect to our world? And how does one access, or how does one open that eye, open one's Dharma eye, that inner eye, so that one can see that inner world, that or that hidden world, that unseen world, so that it becomes seen? And it's said then that the Buddha then had a vision. The Dharma eye was open, and one of the descriptions in the ancient texts is of enlightenment is a process of vision. Sometimes it's called darshana marga, the path of vision, is to have a sight, to see something. And what is it the Buddha saw? What is it? What was that vision that came about? The next step of the whole process was, in the myth, is the Buddha's not just having a vision, seeing something was unseen before, but then being changed by that vision so that his orientation of how he lived his life for the next 40-45 years was informed by that vision. Was in some sense maybe propelled by that vision. So it's one thing to kind of, you know, as difficult it might be, to open the Dharma eye to see the unseen world. It's another thing then to really take that in, to allow oneself to be changed by that so that it, you know, when one is changed. So the aspects of this myth that I kind of would like you to consider, but you can consider anything, but it's a couple of things. One is the idea of holding fast. The night of his enlightenment, the Buddha held fast. He held in there. He had a certain kind of strength where he sat still, come what may. When is it that this, does this point to some kind of important truth for us in our lives, that there are times when we need to hold fast. We need to hold steady. We need to sit still, perhaps, in the midst of tremendous challenges, difficulties, against all maybe logic that tells us this is ridiculous, maybe at some point. Is there a point in life where holding fast with difficulties, with life, is what's called upon? Is there somebody holding fast that gives a possibility of opening up to this Dharma eye? And what is it to open the Dharma eye? What is it to see something unseen? What is the unseen world that becomes accessible when we hold fast? So that's my question for you. What does it mean to hold fast? What's your experience of holding fast? And what does it mean to open the Dharma eye? What is the unseen world that's available to us when we, you know, follow this process? So did I set it up well enough for you guys to kind of bounce off that? Remember that in interpreting dreams, you know, you can be quite creative. So what is your take on this? What is your relationship or interpretation of this, these aspects of a classic Buddhist myth? Yes?
I thought maybe that the Dharma eye means seeing reality, seeing the way things really are without being obscured with all kinds of mental constructions.
Uh-huh. So seeing how things are without the mental constructions. And good, thank you. And what's the role of holding fast? Holding steady.
Without being still, you can't really expect to see through all these things that surround us constantly.
Uh-huh. So without holding still, we can't expect to see through these things which are always here. And so I appreciate a lot what you said, but it belies a certain other question, and that is, what does it mean to see things as they are? What is it that we see? What's the unseen world that is not then seen?
Seeing ourselves and how we react.
Seeing ourselves and how we react. Right? That's good. You know, and also I want to encourage you in interpreting something like this, you don't have to look for the right answer. The right answer is how this kind of speaks to you in your own experience, and rather than some classic Buddhist, you know, meaning of this kind of myth. So anyway, that's good. Yes?
I think I just want to say that everything we see in the world around us is colored by ourselves. So maybe sort of seeing the world as it is stripping oneself away, so when it's not there, and when it's seeing things without oneself reflected.
Uh-huh. So the idea of some aspect of self or self are stripped away. And so we can see things more without the filter of self, self-concept, self-definition. And why is it important to hold fast then to do that?
Because one is very inclined to see oneself in everything or project oneself in everything around. So holding fast and not trying not to do that.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yes?
I was thinking that to see everything, to see the unity of life and your relationship to this, to the larger picture.
So to see the unity of life, to see our relationship to the larger picture. So often our relationship to life in a large sense is obscured, is part of the unseen world, because we're normally what?
We only see the tangible, and so we think that that's the only real thing.
Uh-huh.
But you can get a sense of something larger than just this physical world.
Uh-huh. Great. Thank you.
I'm supposed to write a short thing for this month's newsletter about long retreats. And so I'm thinking in those terms now, and I'm going to answer this question in those terms. So seems to me the great value of long retreats is that you have made that commitment to sit without any distraction, without any escape, avoidance. And in that process, you're really forced by that commitment to start to see through all of your delusions. And because the delusions that keep coming up become so empty and preposterous over time. And I think in my own experience, it's that constant sitting that breaks down these deceptions that we have about ourselves and in the way we look at things.
Mm-hmm.
And as this fellow over here referred to, that everything we're looking at is a projection.
Mm-hmm.
We can see as our own projections, and you just start to break through that.
And what's
it's essential to that.
And then to take one step further, then once you've broken through those delusions, what does the Dharma eye see?
I can't say it any better than the Buddha did. You know, it's the Four Noble Truths and the suffering and lack of and the non-self and impermanence. That seems to be what it all comes down to.
Uh-huh. Beautiful. Thank you. One thought in reaction to what you was stimulated by what you said is going on long retreats sometimes is an incomparable test of how well our understanding is really integrated into our whole being. There's a lot of people who have great sense, great understandings, and some of them very true, very real kind of visions about how things are. Some understanding about themselves, about how free they are in some way. And it might be true, but human beings have a tremendous capacity at self-delusion. And retreats are one of those places where we can really test how true our self-concepts, self-ideas, our ideas of our own freedom, the ideas of our own spiritual understanding, how real they really are. And so because you put under the fire of that, and if it's not real, if it's not really somehow that you've been transformed in some deep way, it becomes really obvious in the fire of the retreat. So I think of retreats as being a great test. Yeah.
So I was, it's interesting to hear that self-doubt was the final step before the Buddha was able to relinquish that. And I can imagine for him being the first person ever to have been enlightened.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what Mara would try to put in his head is, well, what makes you think you've got it, right? You know, other people, you know, they might eat mushrooms or something. They got it. What makes you think you have the right way? And to translate that back into what I feel sometimes in myself is, in our modern day, we are exposed, and we can be exposed to lots of different kinds of teaching, even within Buddhism. I mean, if you go to the bookstore, you see four different magazines about Buddhism. And I just read in Business Week, there's this guy who started a company, and he's based on Eastern spiritual practices and this and that. And it creates some self-doubt in my own mind. Is Vipassana the right way to practice? Maybe Zen is the right way to practice, you know. And that's raised a lot of doubt in my own mind. And I guess the way I approach it is, I guess two things. One is not to come to a conclusion. Because I think you can run into all kinds of corners if you try to come to a conclusion. Like if you're seeking to find out what is the right way.
Right.
And the way to do that, I think, is in part to be patient. Just not... I mean, they go together. You know, you don't want to come to a conclusion. In order not to, you got to force yourself to just sit and just
hold
not
fast.
Trying to come to a conclusion.
Uh-huh. Beautiful.
Am I doing it right?
Great. It's beautiful. So he's. I don't know if you heard. Could hear? Can you hear? That the idea that we have a spiritual supermarket, and not just But even within Buddhism, because there's so many different choices to be made, you go to the bookstore and there's four different Buddhist magazines and all these different books, and there's different Buddhist traditions, and there's Vipassana and there's Zen, and how do you know which one is a true one? It'd be nice to know. And there's all this doubt then about, you know, what's true and all that. And Henry, right? Henry said that his conclusion is, or tentative conclusion, is not to make a conclusion about which one is true, but rather be patient. And in not having a conclusion, be patient, just hold steady, I guess, that something will be revealed, something will show itself. And there's a few things I'd say in response to that. One is sometimes I counsel people who are wondering, you know, there's all these wonderful Buddhist traditions and other spiritual traditions around, and which one should they do, which one is true. And I say, initially, it doesn't really matter which one you choose. Just choose one for a year or something. And do that a year or two or something. And do that, you know, well, the best you can. Because a year of any spiritual practice, hopefully, is going to open up some different eye, some Dharma eye, some spiritual eye, where you have a different ability to see really what's being said, see what's being practiced, see what's being manifested in the community or whatever. And so it doesn't, you know, initially it doesn't really matter what you choose. And then after a while, then you can kind of take, you know, survey the scene again, and you have a new eye to understand, to see. Maybe you won't have as much projection because you kind of see in your capacities for projection, so you can pick up really what's going on. So that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect, which I've told the story many times of my hallucination when I was a new Zen student. Have you heard that? My hallucination was I was a new, enthusiastic, idealistic Zen student, and I sat down to do my Zen meditation. We sit facing the wall, and the wall was this far away. And suddenly, sitting there, this Roman column rose up in front of me, and it's massive, kind of like, you know, kind of column you have in front of a bank that shows you have a lot of banks have a lot of authority and stability, and written down across black, kind of engraved letters, was the word, the letters Z-E-N. And so then I went to embrace this great source of authority. And as I embraced it, the column disappeared and I hit my head against the wall. So I took that as a lesson that I should be very careful not to look outside of myself for the answer, as if some tradition, it had it, the Zen had it, or Vipassana has it. Or yes?
It seems to me, Gil, that we're talking about the place where this actually becomes a religion. We're talking about the step before Nibbana, the step you're enlightened and therefore you achieve Nibbana after you die. So, and that's, according to the Buddha, incomprehensible. And to me, it's incomprehensible. So it's the point at which you have to take it on faith that what you see when you become enlightened is important, is a central part of your life. It's the point at which this is you have to have faith in what's going to happen. You can't understand it, it's just going to happen to you.
Uh-huh.
And it's important and you should do it. And so the stillness, if you believe that, then the stillness is the way that you achieve it. And if you're not still, you don't get there. So you can't say that's what it is because there's no way of knowing. It's just there.
So Bill brings up the question of is there a degree, element of faith that's not really verifiable until you've been there, get there in some ways, involved in a spiritual life like Buddhism? And faith that there is an unseen world to attain or to reach, or faith that it's possible to, you know, open Dharma eye. In the particular thing that you brought up, it's very interesting because classic Buddhist teaching is that once a person becomes fully enlightened, they continue living their life in the way they normal people live their lives, you know, at least the way enlightened people live their lives. And then when they die, then they will no longer get reborn. And Buddhism believes in these constant cycles of rebirth. And then the question is, if an enlightened person doesn't get reborn, what happens to them? You know, do they get, you know, they don't get reborn in heavens, they don't get reborn, you know, as human, they don't get reborn any place. But what, you know, what happens to them? Do they disappear? They become extinct? It's like just the flame goes out and it's no longer there. Just you die and that's it. And what the Buddha seemed to have said was that what happens to a fully enlightened person when that person dies cannot be described, cannot be talked about, is incomprehensible. So then Bill suggests that, well, if that's the ultimate destination of an enlightened person, even having a Dharma eye open, even having Dharma eye open doesn't really tell you what's there next because it's incomprehensible after you die. So it's an article of faith to kind of believe in that possibility or whatever. And so that makes sense. However, my reading of the early Buddhist tradition is that a person who becomes enlightened is no longer concerned with what happens to them after they die. So it's not really an issue about you know, taking it on faith or believing or not believing it. It's just simply not, you know, that's not a, you know, such an interesting question. The Dharma, the opening of the Dharma eye has given a person this kind of freedom where then when the life is settled or one finds one's peace there. So, yes?
This is a strange topic to talk about because I think it's had, well, when a Buddha dies, I mean, well, what dies? Well, the body dies. And it also says, the Buddha also says that you're not the five conditions. And if you really contemplate the five conditions, it goes, oh no, there's the body, there's the aspect we that automatically happens in our experience. We experience things as pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. There's what's called perception, which a lot has to do with memory, that you see something, like I look at Gil, I say, mine says Gil, or this is a building. Third one is our volition for doing things, or our force for doing things, this consciousness that we have. Something enters our six senses, and we know, and so there's consciousness. So what else is there? And I think if you contemplate it, that's what we view as the world. So if we're not that, what is it? What do you really say about it? So, you know, my personal opinion is full of mourning. It's, as they say, a thicket of views, and just creates more views. And I agree with Ajahn Amaro, who says basically, you know, enlightenment's a good thing to go after, and it's the end of suffering. Richard Chapman says it also. That's his opinion on the text. If you look at it, all it really says is enlightenment is the end of suffering. Or even suffering, I think, is a bad translation also, because it brings up a lot of connotations and views.
So in the text where it talks about the Buddha attaining his awakening, his freedom, it talks about him opening the Dharma eye. So according to your idea, your interpretation, your view here today, what does he see when the Dharma eye opens?
So maybe it's different paths. I remember the quote, Dharma eye, where he sees all the past lives and all of this stuff. And then he says he turned his eye towards dukkha, then he saw the cause of dukkha, so the end of dukkha, and then he saw the end of dukkha, and then he saw the path leading to the end of dukkha.
Dukkha, for those of you who don't know, means suffering.
That's one translation.
Yeah.
They even pinning it down on suffering, being Tassar Vigo, who translates as stress.
So you're saying with the Dharma eye open, Well, you're pointing to the central thing that he saw was something to do with the nature of dukkha, of suffering or stress or unsatisfactoriness, and the freedom from that, the liberation from that. Right. That's what he saw. And so the unseen world would then be this process, understanding how this process works, how dukkha occurs and how dukkha can be brought to an end. Right. Is that what you're saying? And so, and holding steady, holding fast, how does that relate to that process of that Dharma eye opening?
Well, requires effort.
Sorry?
It requires effort.
It requires effort?
To do practices. I mean, it just doesn't come naturally. Our natural tendency is to grasp.
Yes?
Is it your experience that people that follow the Buddhist path in other societies, particularly Asian societies, have an easier time holding fast than people in Western societies?
That's a hard question to answer, and it's fraught with danger to start making cultural comparisons and things like that. People have noticed. I mean, I know there's a number of things that I've noticed culturally, East and West, kind of. I've noticed that Eastern teachers are amazed at the tenacity and the strong effort that some Westerners can make. I've heard Eastern teachers say something like, boy, if my Eastern students practice as hard as these Westerners, they'd all be enlightened by now. Because, you know, there's this work ethic or whatever it is that, you know, we bring. And so you know, there's ability to, Westerners bring this great, you know, ability sometimes to hold fast sometimes. Another observation I've seen about the difference is that all this really strong effort and holding fast by the Westerners when they practice in Asia doesn't bear as much fruit as the more relaxed approach that some of the Asian people have. Sometimes the Asians, you know, when they go to, you know, Burmese goes to a Burmese temple, it's like a homecoming for them. You know, they feel at home. It's their kind of religion of birth, and they grew up in going to the temples with their family, and it feels very comfortable. So they go there and they kind of relax in a very deep way. An American goes to a temple in Burma, and they bring with them their parents, and having justified themselves to their parents, and, you know, and why aren't you getting a job, and you should go back to school, and, you know, they don't feel at home there. They can just relax. It's like it's all this anxiety that comes up. So if it's fair to make cultural comparisons like this, then it depends on what particular areas of one's personal life one looks at. Maybe in some areas, one culture has a really great capacity to hold fast. And in other aspects, other cultures have great abilities to hold fast.
The reason why I asked was a comment that Sri Lanka here made, if I was to restate it. Holding fast, at least in my own experience, holding fast to the extent that I can in the face of temptation of any sort requires real clarity of insight relative to the futility of life as it's ordinarily lived. And it's also my experience that in this society, a big part of society's job is to continually convince us that there's always hope. That no matter how things look, get another degree, find another relationship, lose weight, there's always something on the life level that makes life as it's ordinarily lived worth living. And therefore, temptation becomes that more difficult to resist. I was just curious if in a less sort of souped-up, hyped-up culture, where people are hit with fewer such images, there might be more of a sense of futility about life as it's ordinarily lived. And that was what triggered that. Again, you're right, it is pretty highly generalized.
It's hard to know. Please.
You talked about mythology, and I was seeing it not not only Buddhist, but also it's a universal just of transformation. Whether it's a retreat, we face the difficult parts of ourselves. And for me, the first few days are usually extremely hard, and then there's just a total opening for the last couple of days. And the same experience on a vision quest, and I was thinking, just facing any hardship, any healing like vets that are able to heal from that trauma, or you know, anyone going through therapy or the loss of a relationship, all the same thing. The hardship that one's willing to face it with that intention, there's a transformation.
I agree. I completely agree. So being hospitalized for a while, you know, or being on one's deathbed and all kinds of stuff. And it's almost as if the greater one's suffering is in different situations, it's almost a direct relationship between the strength or the strength of the suffering. Let's say it this way: suffering has a lot to do with our values, our priorities, our view of ourselves and the world around us. And the greater we suffer, the stronger are the views and the priorities and values that are feeding into that suffering. And so suffering becomes, for many traditions, an entry point to the spiritual life, because it's a place where we can really kind of grapple or deal with the values, the beliefs, the attachments that are part of the soil for that suffering. And the greater the suffering, the greater the opportunity there is to see what's going on there for us. And all kinds of situations provide that. So you had a hand up earlier.
I have a similar viewpoint, is that oftentimes what brings us to practice is the suffering.
Yeah.
And holding fast is being able to meet it with some without aversion, or see it as an opportunity to open the dharma.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And in that path, there may be a series of many elements, or that you're using the suffering as an opportunity.
Thank you, yeah. Yes, please.
And just to kind of connect with her idea is that it seems that it is this process. And when we hear about the Buddha's enlightenment, it's like, boing, you know, it happens at one particular moment. But he went through many different lifestyles to try and find that which would bring him that equanimity state. And that it maybe it happened completely at one point, but my own experience is that over time, that's the holding fast, that this Dharma eye, which we're calling today, is a process of opening, and that it doesn't necessarily just blink open and say, there it is. But it's this little bit by little bit. Yesterday, I saw a woman that I haven't seen for 33 years, and we've been very close at that time. And just in the conversation, I realized how much had happened in our lives spiritually, and certainly life and its sufferings and its joys, and that both of us had the sense that there was this coming over and opening up to something greater through the life itself, and that it didn't happen in one day, it happened over 33 years and more.
Yeah, a lot of wisdom can happen through just a life experience and aging. And the joke I make about that is that Buddhism is accelerated aging. Speeds up the process. But I have another question I'd like to ask all of you before we end here. In that holding fast might be a very important part of the spiritual path or practice or life wisdom. So just staying alive and going through it all, you know, is a big deal for some people. But what are the qualities we need to bring? What do we need to bring to bear? What kind of personal qualities do we need to call on or call forth in order to have the ability to hold fast, to hold steady? I mean, could you say we just do it? Just sit down and, you know, dig your stake into the ground and hold on tight. But what are some of the qualities that support and make it possible for you to hold fast, hold steady? Yeah.
I have a vision.
A vision?
A vision of freedom.
A vision of freedom. So having a vision, having some confidence in the possibility of freedom, that there's a you're involved in a process, and that process has an end in freedom. It makes it possible for you to hang in there and hold steady. Great. Thank you. Yes?
Willingness to let go of whatever comes up.
So a willingness to let go of whatever comes up. Mm-hmm. Good.
I like to use the word surrender.
So, to be able to surrender. Good.
You're not pushing or pulling. You're basically just being. Uh-huh. And your ability to, I guess, just let things go through you as opposed to getting stuck on you is an analogy that I like to use.
So the idea of surrender, the idea of being rather than doing, and the idea of letting things move through you rather than letting things get stuck.
But it doesn't mean you're lazy. It doesn't mean you're lazy. Mm. It means that you know what you're doing. You know that you've made a choice to surrender to the process of awakening. You're not forcing anything. You're not trying to achieve anything. You just know that this process is working, and you're not getting in the way. Uh-huh. That's what I mean by surrender.
So surrender is not being lazy.
Right.
Good.
Not being lazy.
Yes, Jen.
I would say slowing down at least a little bit in your activities.
Slowing down, good. Yes.
Probably knowing that you're not running away from yourself.
Knowing you're not running away from yourself.
Anywhere else do you have protection?
Good.
Wherever you go, you take that with you. Uh-huh.
And face it. Good. Yes?
It's also a matter of prioritizing, because we feel so much pressure to be doing things, and at times when I'm going to sit, I think, oh, I can't really indulge myself by doing that. And I think, well, it's as important as anything else that I'm going to do. And in fact, in the long term, it's more important than anything else I'm going to do. But in our society, we there's so many things competing and pressuring us to actually, and particularly for me, it's something that a lot of people around me don't even know I do. So to pull myself out of where I am, go away and do this, is at times difficult. And so I try to set a very high priority.
Great. Thank you. So prioritizing. Yes?
Deep belief.
Sorry?
Deep belief.
Deep belief. Uh-huh. Yes?
I hesitate to use the word. I call it discipline.
Discipline, having a sense of discipline. Yes?
I think patience, really, to be able to let the process take its course and not to say why I think happening is best and not going to happen. You know, am I doing this right? Am I doing this wrong? To just relax and have the patience to continue on.
Great, thank you. Good. Bill?
It seems to me that you're balancing all these things on ahead of. And I think the one thing that nobody's mentioned yet is there's got to be a tremendous amount of courage and tenacity. Mm-hmm. You have to sort of, you know, take hold of it and make yourself sit down and do it. Mm-hmm. But if you get like this too much, then the balance falls out and you're sitting there with your jaws locked. And so you have to relax. You have to do all of these things simultaneously, or it's real balancing.
Yes, Lewis.
So the other thing that hasn't been mentioned, and that perhaps comes more from the concentration side, is pleasure.
Good. And that's what, you know, the Buddha discovered. You know, he was reminded of this childhood experience that was filled with joy, and it was a childhood experience of not trying to make anything happen. Not trying to avoid anything from happening, just kind of resting. And some people would say resting in the nature of mind. And then in that doing that, all the stuff comes. And the Buddha just stayed there. He wasn't tempted. He wasn't thrown off by it. And all these illusions, delusions, and temptations and emotions all kind of swirled around him. But he stayed in that relaxed mode. I like that. Sometimes I... Since the Buddha was reminded of his childhood experience he had, I sometimes like to think of it as learning to sit with a childlike openness, but with adult-like stability. So that balance of the two. Childlike openness is, by itself maybe doesn't really work, but adult-like stability by itself doesn't work, but the two together. So this is where they, you know, balancing these different factors. And there's a couple of other factors that I thought of that haven't been mentioned. And one is respect. And classically, in many different traditions, having an element of respect for yourself, for what you're doing, for the tradition, for the teachings, is often considered to be a prerequisite for being able to go onto the path, or doing the work, holding steady. There's a, you know, in Buddhism and probably in other religions, some idea that as a person is not supposed to actually teach the Dharma to anybody unless they feel that the people are coming with some modicum of respect for what's happening. The other I thought of is compassion. That I think it's helpful to have a tremendous amount of compassion for oneself and for the world around one. And often it's compassion that gives the strength and the courage to hang in there for whatever it takes. And someone talked about, you know, how these things happen in small steps and increments. And I think the degree to which our Dharma eye opens a little bit, it gives us the possibility of trying to, you know, take the next step or to hold steady even more, or learn how to receive what's going on next with as much spaciousness and freedom as possible. And that then it opens up another eye, or opens the eye wider. And often it's not just like Big Bang kind of theory, but rather it can be incremental along the way. And I'd like to end with this. I'm going to talk about my experience of being in Japan, and I apologize for talking about another culture that maybe I don't know so much about. But it's not so much about Japanese culture, but about the experience of the Westerners, the Americans, who went to Japan and lived in Japan. I saw a relatively common pattern. Many Westerners, many Americans would go to Japan and fall in love with it firsthand. Just, it was also very romantic, it was very charming, it was very, you know, it's all these wonderful, beautiful qualities of Japanese culture that you see when you first get there. And then the ones who stayed there for a while, maybe lived there for an extended period of time, after about 3 months, they would suddenly see, wait a minute, there's something going on here that doesn't meet the eye when you first get there. And many of them could be quite disturbed by what they saw in Japanese culture after the first 3 months. And they saw kind of behind, you know, their social relationships and how people relate to each other, and the hierarchy and the status, and the, you know, it's very complicated. Japanese culture is very stratified and very complex in many ways, and very un-American in terms of equality. And an American, many Americans would be quite disturbed. Some people would leave Japan after kind of looking under the surface and seeing what was there. But then those who stayed longer, those who stayed maybe more than 6 months, their eyes would open even further. And then what I saw was that then they would find this deeper appreciation of Japan and Japanese culture. And again, they felt very happy being there. But there was a transition period of about 2 or 3 months where it was very difficult to be there because they saw certain aspects of it but not others. I don't want to make this a comment about Japanese culture. It's about how people observe Japanese culture from Westerners who were there. But I'd suggest the same process. So it was important to kind of hold steady, to stay there long enough to see it through, the part that where the Westerners kind of didn't understand what was going on or didn't appreciate what was going on. So the same thing occurs, I think, with any spiritual discipline, that there, and certainly with Buddhism, that initially the first period, 3 months, 3 years, 30 years, I don't know how long, depends, you know, on the individual. But it's just great. You know, it's just fantastic. You know, it's just a wonderful world religion. It's inspiring. It's great. And there's kind of beginner's luck. You sit down to meditate, and it's so exciting. And people get settled and concentrated very easily because it's so great to be, you know, to be inspired and do this wonderful thing. It could be said that initially many people are enchanted by the possibility, enchanted by the great teachings, enchanted by the great teachers. And there's a kind of, you know, sense of hopefulness that gets kind of projected on. And you know, like I did when I was a young Zen student, I projected onto this great Zen tradition that I was going to hold on to and it's going to save my life. And I was enchanted by it, right, in this hallucination. And then sooner or later, people involved in Buddhism get disenchanted with Buddhism. And I would suggest that this is actually a very healthy. We're looking for this to happen. We love it when people get disenchanted, because you're supposed to. I mean, if you're enchanted, you're in trouble. And so to be disenchanted in some way, it needs to happen. But the word disenchanted in English kind of has the connotations of, it's kind of dismal, you know. Kind of like, you know, disenchanted means you kind of go into some kind of blah, you know. But disenchanted means you're no longer enchanted. Enchanted is almost another word for being in illusion. So you're supposed to get disillusioned by Buddhism. Isn't that great? Because the alternative is to be in illusion about it. And that's, you know, Buddhists don't want to live in illusion. So you have to get disillusioned with Buddhism even. And then at this point, many people will leave. And then they'll go to some other great practice or religion or, you know, do folk dancing instead or something. And have great, you know, hope and great projection onto that. And then they'll do that for 3 months or whatever long it takes until they get disillusioned with that. And so a few people will go through a process where they only take a particular tradition to the point where they get disillusioned, where it no longer has a great allure or whatever. And then they leave and they go somewhere, something else. Sooner or later, I think, in order, as someone said, you know, you take yourself with you everywhere. Sooner or later, it's better just to kind of, you know, hold fast. And the experience of people hold fast with the Buddhist tradition that I've seen, if they hang through that period of disillusionment, then at some point it opens up to a whole new dimension. And that dimension, I think, is in some ways then freed of Buddhism. And some of the comments people made about the Four Noble Truths, I think are very, very profound teachings that the Buddha and Buddhism has to teach, that arises out of a phase of Buddhist practice where one begins to see the alternative to any kind of illusion, living in illusions, and about life. So now you've been forewarned. Those of you who need to be forewarned, and those of you who have gone through this, just reminded of something that you've already experienced. So with that, I hope that those of you who are still in illusion and those who are still enchanted will all be properly disenchanted and disillusioned and be a lot happier because of it. Thank you.